All right, thanks a lot, everybody. I'm Joe Phillips. I'm a recovered alcoholic. How are y'all doing? My last drink was April 3rd, 1991. Been a while. More about that later. My home group is the Preamblers in Charlottesville. We meet twice a week, Wednesdays and Sundays at 8 o'clock. It's at the Wesley Memorial Church, 1901 Thompson Road. Wednesday's Big Book. Sunday's Step Study. That's kind of why I go there. And so y'all are welcome anytime you're down our way. I understand it's pretty basic stuff, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't spend a lot of time on the what it was like part. I'm an alcoholic. We all know what it was, you know, what the consequences were like. I don't spend a lot of time on drunkologues. I belong here. I cut to the chase. I'm an alcoholic not because of what happened to me when I'm drinking or when I was drinking, but I'm an alcoholic because I have a physical reaction when I drink and because I have a mental obsession to drink. Rather, I can thankfully say today I had a mental obsession to drink. So I look at those two points, and I was the kind of person that, you know, one drink never made sense. The only time I ever had one drink was when one drink was all that was available. I drank until I passed out or ran out of booze, and that was just the way it was like. I'm married to a woman who's a normal drinker, and to this day, I still can look at her drinking and think she's doing it wrong. She'll open a beer and, you know, drink some of it, and the last half is warm, and so she pours it out. You know, it's just not going to work that way. I never drank like that. I always wanted to drink more. And like I say, I either passed out or ran out. The other piece of that is the mental obsession, and the best way for me to describe that is towards the end of my drinking days, the last 2 or 3 years, I'd settled into a pattern pretty much of getting drunk every evening, passing out, waking up in the middle of the night kind of in a panic. If there was any booze left in the house, I'd drink to get back to sleep, and then wake up in the morning feeling, you know, really terrible. Not physically terrible so much as emotionally terrible. I wasn't going to get drunk last night, but I had anyway. I hadn't done any of the number of things that I had to do the night before, so I was guilty about that, and it was just, you know, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not. And I didn't want to. I didn't want to drink that day, and I was serious about my belief that I wouldn't drink that day. If you'd put a lie detector on me, it would have shown that I was telling you the truth. And I'd go through the day, and then at 5 o'clock, I'd get off work, and then without any thought involved in the process, I'd be in the parking lot of the nearest convenience store with a tall boy. I wasn't thinking I'll just have one. I wasn't thinking at all. It was one of those struck drunk things. I would have one drink, and then that would kick in, you know. Once I'd done that, I'd stop at the grocery store just before I got home to get a half gallon of wine. You know, because you want to drink a little wine with dinner. And so that cycle was just kind of an over and over and over thing. You know, that was the daily stuff. I drank more on the weekends, but, you know, that's kind of what the deal was like. In terms of my background, I was the oldest of three kids. I grew up born in Lynchburg, but I grew up in Hampton. Looking back on it, I think I had a pretty awesome childhood. I had parents that loved me. We didn't talk a lot. There wasn't a lot of closeness between my parents and myself, but it was clear that they loved me. It was clear that they wanted the best for me. I thought they pushed me too hard, but I think that's a fairly standard child's reaction to parents. And aside from the lack of communication, you know, I look back and go, wow, way to go, Mom and Dad. I made my amends to them, some years ago, and as parents are sometimes wont to do, they were willing to take responsibility for my alcoholism. It must have been something we did. No, really. I have a brother and a sister, and they're not alcoholic, right? So okay. But alcohol was in the household all the time. I've got a picture of me in diapers and a white T-shirt sitting on the kitchen counter in Lynchburg with a full bottle of bourbon. Yeah, so I was somehow comfortable with the notion that drinking was something that people did every day after they got off work. And growing up, I was, again, the oldest of three. I was the one who was expected to do real well in school, and I did. I was, you know, a high achiever, even though I was, you know, push, kicking, and screaming into that role, kind of a perfectionist deal. And so I didn't drink because, you know, I was very afraid of breaking the rules. I thought that kind of the way you approach life was you did what you were supposed to do and then your life would somehow be good. You know, pretty naive outlook on life. But so I didn't drink for until I was about 17. And as a teenager in high school, I was very, very uncomfortable. I got to school after grade school. I went to this, you know, middle school, and I walk in and I just look around me and I just know it's not going to work. Everyone looked like they were comfortable and knew what they were doing, and I had no clue. And I knew I wasn't going to fit in. I knew no one was going to like me. I knew there was something wrong with me. I think most of you know what some kind of that feeling is like. As I've been in the fellowship for some years, that seems to be a common theme, this internal disease. And I struggled with that. I wanted more than anything to be accepted by the people around me. And one of the things they did was drink beer. And one evening I was down at a party in some, you know, kid's house, and they had a basement rec room, and down there, and a guy gave me a Schlitz tall boy, and I took a sip of that, and I just couldn't believe that anybody would voluntarily drink anything that tasted that bad. I mean, it was just hideous. But I was more afraid of what everyone was going to think of me if I didn't drink that beer. And so I did. And this is when it happened. All of a sudden, I was comfortable around all those people. You know, it was amazing. It was almost instantaneous. It didn't take much. I was comfortable in my own skin, able to talk to those people. I'm not real sure what I said, but it didn't really matter. The point is that alcohol fixed that thing for me. And that's, having the spiritual malady doesn't make me an alcoholic, but to me, a big piece of my alcoholism and understanding why I drank the way I did and why alcohol was so important to me to begin with was that it fixed that stuff. It was my higher power. You know, all of the concern I had that I wasn't going to measure up or that you weren't going to like me or that there was something wrong with me, all that was gone when I was drinking. And I didn't realize it at the time, but alcohol became vitally important to me at that moment. Took a long time for the drinking to kick in serious measure, but I look back at things that I did while I was still living at home, and I would go to any lengths to get alcohol, even a little alcohol. So it was pretty important. And that's kind of the third piece of the puzzle. I'm an alcoholic because of the allergy and the obsession. But the spiritual malady is a big piece of this thing, because alcohol fixed that for me, and it explains to me why it was such an important part of my life. So I went on with my life, and alcohol was a part of it. I went to school. I guess all things said, I was a functioning alcoholic. I went to school, didn't learn much, came to the University of Virginia in the 70s, and boy, that was for someone who had had a hard time finding alcohol, the University of Virginia was hard to for someone like me to believe. Rush happened in the first week, and it was like all of a sudden total strangers were concerned that I had enough to drink. And so I won't say that I used that opportunity to my best advantage from a standpoint of education. From the standpoint of drinking, I wrung every little bit out of it. I went through school. I got married. I was married to my first wife for almost 13 years. And we drank together. We helped each other drink. It was a good match from that standpoint. I traveled around. You know, again, I don't want to get too much into the stories because they don't really play into things. But we went around from Virginia to Texas to New Orleans. New Orleans was another good place for a drinker. Buy a drugstore brand scotch and walk around in the street with it. But the bottom line was, about 12 years into the marriage, I was at this point where I described to you that I was getting drunk every day. I wasn't a lot of fun to be around, and my wife came to me and said she didn't love me anymore and she was leaving. And keep in mind that I was the kind of person that wanted desperately to fit in and wanted you to like me. And I gotta look honestly at my motives for marriage and the kind of, person I was and what I brought to the marriage. And a lot of being married for me that first time was so that I would look good to the world. I mean, I was playing the role. Got a good marriage, got a family, got a wife, Must be a heck of a guy. And so here's where the self-centeredness of that comes in. When my wife told me that, I mean, my first reaction was instant denial. So, oh, no, everything's going to be fine. We'll get this squared away. I was in immediate denial. The marriage was already over. I just didn't know it yet. But I was the one person who was sure that we were going to fix this. But the reaction I had after that wasn't, what's wrong with our relationship? What have I done to Robin? What's going on here? My second reaction after the denial was, what are other people going to think? How am I going to tell my parents? Yeah, my parents never got divorced. My brother and sister didn't get divorced. Here's that evidence that I'm a failure. So it became very important to me to try and fix this thing. So my wife was willing to go to counseling. It's kind of an exit strategy on her part. But we went to counseling, and at the end of the first session, the therapist said, I got a couple of standard questions. Number one, is there any violence in the house? And we both go, no violence. Second question, is there any alcohol or substance abuse going on? And we both go, yeah, that would be yes. And so we made an appointment out at Blue Ridge and went out there, had about a 15-minute consult with a fellow out there. It took him about 5 minutes to make his diagnosis. And for me, this was kind of cool news. I was going to go to treatment, and that was going to fix my marriage. So I went in 28-day outpatient. The one thing they didn't tell me when I asked what the program was about was that really what that program was for was a bridge to AA. I heard a lot of good things in there. One of the most important things I heard in treatment was that there's a difference between religion and spirituality. That was real important. Again, I've been in the rooms for a number of years, and we all run up against that religion cult thing, or not all of us, but a lot of us. It's a very common thing. And so it was very important for me to distinguish, to have someone point out that there was a difference, you know, that this was kind of a spiritual deal, but it wasn't a religious deal. And that was helpful. But I heard some things that didn't help, and I didn't know they wouldn't help at the time. I mean, I'm just, you know, this sponge soaking this stuff up. They said, don't go past the third step your first year. And they also said, if you're ever having a problem or a bad day, go to a meeting and make it your own. Yeah. This is kind of the second part of my story. I came into the rooms as part of this 28-day treatment program, picked up a white chip, and started hearing what there was to hear in AA. And I heard about the 12 steps. Mostly I saw the 12 steps on the wall. I also heard it's an individual program. I heard take your time to work the steps. And again, keep in mind, I'm an alcoholic. I'm looking for the easier, softer way. So if I'm weighing on this hand, I've got this guy over here telling me, you know, you do this stuff, you do it the way we tell you to do it. Just don't worry about why. Just get off your butt and do it. And then we got people over here, more people than this, saying, well, do it your way and, you know, take your time. And, you know, and I'd heard that in treatment, too. They're backing up what I've heard in treatment. Those people are professionals. So I just hopped all over the easier, softer way. And I started going to at least 3 meetings a week. I didn't drink a day at a time. From time to time, I had sponsors that were people that I thought, if you knew that so-and-so was my sponsor, then I'm probably, you know, pretty solid, because he's solid. He looks good. I look good. I did whatever steps were comfortable for me to do, usually on my own. I'll give a quick example. My first run at the... I had two runs at the fourth step early on. The first sponsor I had, who was kind of working me through that, said, well, why don't you just write your life story? Okay, so I did that. You know, there's no inventory involved in that, but it was a pleasant little exercise to sit out at his place and talk about myself for a couple of hours. The second run at it was, I'd read the big book, and I could probably pass a test on it, but I had no conception of it from a standpoint of explaining what alcoholism is or telling you how to get well. But they've got that little column thing in there for the fourth step. And so I did a 2-column resentment inventory and called it a fourth step. Didn't do any of the other inventories suggested. Didn't really get past what the book refers to appropriately as a grudge list. I made a list of who I was angry at in column 1, and in column 2 I said why they had it coming. And that was it. You know? End of that inventory, you know, and what happened was is I kind of got bogged down at 6 and 7. Surprise, surprise. Because what happens is that I had identified that I was angry and resentful, which was progress. But when I got to, you know, God remove these defects of character, the only thing I knew to ask to have relief was my anger and resentment. Now, if I think about that now, you know, what I was asking for was to have my symptoms removed without fixing what was wrong with me. You know, I want to continue to misbehave. I just want to feel good about it. You know, so it's pretty easy to see why that didn't work. And I wasn't getting, you know, so I bogged down at 6 and 7, which was a good thing because there was no way I was going near 8 and 9. And so I did this for a long time, guys. I got good at coming into meetings and talking. as time went on, my life, you know, I've heard people say, just don't drink a day at a time, go to meetings, and things will get better. And it's just not my experience. I'm here to share my experience. And that is not my experience. Maybe it's somebody's, but it ain't mine. What happened to me is that gradually I got worse and worse and worse. You know, when I did speak in meetings, I was complaining about something. Who was doing me wrong? My family, my kids, my job. You know, who's got a topic? Oh, resentment, anger and resentment. And meetings, actually, when I look back on it, meetings were making it worse for me. Because here's what's happening in meetings. I'm going into meetings. I'm sharing a resentment. Everybody's coming up to me at the end of the meeting and going, yeah, we relate. You know, that happened. Me too, all the time. You know, and so everybody's patting me on the back and feeling sorry for me and bucking me up. So for an hour, I have everybody acting the way I expect everybody's supposed to act. They're focused on me. They're telling me I'm a good guy. Just keep, you know, everything's going to be fine. Us too. And then I go back into the world, and well, the rest of the world didn't care that I had a resentment. The rest of the world expected me to play my part. And so I would leave a meeting, and it would just fuel resentments, because I'd go home, and they weren't treating me at home the way they were treating me in meetings. So I got madder at them than I was before. You know, and guys, I did this for 10 years. I did this for a long time. I was down at the beach this summer for a long weekend with my wife visiting some friends from North Carolina, and we got on the topic of, you know, this one friend has a brother who's, you know, going through multiple treatments and just isn't getting it together. But, you know, I started talking about, you know, he's in treatment this time. So, well, I hope he gets hooked up with someone solid in the program, someone who's going to take him through the work. And I said, you know, ask Diane what it was like when I was just drinking. You know, and she looked at her friend and said, you know, nothing ever made him happy. You know, nothing ever satisfied him. You know. The way I felt the world was supposed to operate was, you know, on my script, just like it says in the book. You know, I was writing my script and the world wasn't paying attention, and it was kicking my butt. So here we are, you know, here's that third piece of alcoholism. You know, the part that alcohol fixed, and I take the alcohol away, and that stuff is still there, kicking my butt. And it got worse and worse and worse. So this idea of not drinking and it getting better got worse and worse and worse. And then, you know, 10 years of this, I'm lying in bed one night, and I finally hit bottom. Basically, I hit a bottom that got me into the rooms to begin with that had to do with alcohol. And then I finally hit a bottom that had to do with everything else. I hit a bottom with my alcoholism. And I realized that in every way, I felt worse than I'd ever felt in the worst days of my drinking. You know, my wife was lying next to me, but she might have as well have been on Venus. I was afraid to go to sleep. I couldn't talk to her, but I could not talk to her. You know, it's just, I've heard people talk about the committee in their head. You know, and the committee was working overtime. I was just a mess in every way. And so I became willing at that point to do something differently. I went to the 5:30 speaker meeting at JPA, and this guy was talking about doing the steps. Imagine that. What a coincidence. And after all this time, I was thinking that it was going to take a long time. You know, take your time to work the steps, and I had. I thought it was going to be a very lengthy process. And he was saying, yeah, you know, usually it takes about 8 weeks, maybe 10. I said, weeks? Did I hear that right? And so I snagged this guy after the meeting in the parking lot and said, I'm ready to do this deal. He said, I only got two requirements. You do it. You show up on time every time we're supposed to meet, and you do it. And the second is that you carry it to someone else. And so we got rolling with the work, and it was just amazing. I mean, you hear this thing a lot in some meetings. We didn't get this sick overnight. We're not going to get well overnight. I got well almost overnight. It's just amazing. It's just amazing. To the extent that I believe that to the extent you're willing to get down and do the work, you can be well in no time at all. I mean, repairing the damage might take a while, you know. But I was about 4 weeks into it, and I can't remember what step we were working on. I think maybe I was working on my one of my inventories, and I was walking down the steps, and I'd just been, you know, my family and I had just been like this for years. You know, they just couldn't do things the way they needed to do it, and I was on them all the time, and it was for their own good. You know, I only had their interest in mind when I made them do this and made them do that, and they wouldn't do this, and, you know, you get the idea. And so I'm walking down the stairs in my house, and I realize all of a sudden that it's been about a week since I had any conflict at all with my family. You know, we were getting along great. And right on the heels of that came the realization that they were doing everything the same as they'd always done it. It wasn't them. It was me. That was a pretty big one. I mean, you know, people talk about burning bush spiritual experiences and educational variety spiritual experiences. I don't know what kind I had, but I've had some moments where things hit so hard and with such clarity that I've had both. Let me put it that way. I think the other big one during the first run through the steps was my sponsor sandbagged me. We got to the ninth step. He said, okay, take your list, make out these cards. We made out a card for each amend I was going to make with, you know, the person's name and the harm done. And, you know, so that when I got to the door and I started to do this and I started to get nervous, I'd have this thing in front of me that would keep me focused. I said, okay, take those things and, you know, make a plus on every one you're willing to do. I was willing to do all of them. So, okay, now rank them in order from hardest to easiest, you know, and we'll start with the easy ones. And by the time you work your way through all this list, when you get to the tough ones, you'll be comfortable with it and you'll have it down. So I said, okay, so I ranked them and I handed them to him, and he took the four hardest ones and said, take care of it. I'll see you in a week. He knew what I needed. He knew what I needed. My ex-wife, the person my ex-wife left me for, my boss, you know, those kinds of amends. And I went to the guy who my wife had left me for, and I don't say this to gossip, I just want to put it in context. He was my best friend for years, and when she left me, he said that he pretended to be my friend for years. I mean, it was ugly, you know. And so I felt I had reason to treat him poorly. She married him. We've got joint custody, so I'm going to, you know, elementary school recitals, and there he is, you know, and I'm treating him really badly. And so I had that amend to make. I had an amend to make to him for how I had treated him over those years, because it wasn't about what he had done. It was about my actions. And so I went over to his house and I prayed in the car, you know, give me the strength to do this. And I went in and made my amend. And it was one of those amends where, you know, you don't get thrown out of the house, but the person you're making the amend to really doesn't get it. But it doesn't matter, you know. And I left that house and I was absolutely aware that my higher power was with me. I'm really not sure my feet touched the ground. it was an incredibly powerful moment because it was so clear to me that I had done something that I didn't have the power to do myself. No way would I do that on my own strength, my own resources. Wasn't going to happen. And so this was just one of those ones where it hammered home that there was a higher power working in my life at that moment. So that was pretty huge. So, the bottom line for this is that, what all this brought home to me was that alcohol wasn't the root of my problem. It's like the book says, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. I wanted all these people to act a certain way, and they didn't do it. Living a life where everything's about me, I cut myself off from any sort of spiritual strength. And that's when that spiritual malady comes in. I've cut myself off from this source of love and strength and grace. And then I wonder what's wrong with the world. It's been put really nicely. I think it's Sandy Beach talks about a higher power being a great threat to me. Because if there is a higher power, then possibly that's the center of the universe. And it's true. And the thing about that is that when I look at the world through a focus that I'm the center, I'm always in conflict because that's not the way the world really is. And when I'm spiritually aligned and I'm looking at it properly, which is that it's God-centered, it makes a whole lot more sense. That explains to me, the difference in my household where, everything's running the way it always is, but I'm just looking at it through the right eyes, and as a result, I'm not causing all this conflict. My kids weren't causing the conflict. I was. Now, as teenagers, they weren't blameless, but the point is that the fundamental, the stuff that they were doing was kid stuff and it was easy. The stuff that I was doing was spiritually sick and it was hurting the family. My sponsor's favorite story is after I started this stuff, and these changes had started to happen. He had a party for a business that he had opened, and Diane and I were there, and Diane went up to him and thanked him for the new husband. It's pretty basic, So what is it like now? Obviously, it's a whole lot better. How am I doing on time? Yeah? Okay. There have been some things that have been really helpful. One of the things that my sponsor did for me, and I don't want to get into this in too much detail. If anyone wants to talk about it after the meeting, I'd be happy to. But there's a passage in the book in We Agnostics where it talks about facing this proposition that God is either everything or nothing. What's our choice to be? And he gave me an exercise to do early on based on that. It's a three-column exercise, and basically I looked at the things that I hadn't turned over to God yet. And my first question was, how do I know? He said, why don't you just look at every part of your life where you're having trouble? So I did, and found out it was pretty much every part of my life that was important. The second column was why I'm afraid to turn those things over to God. And the third column was what God would have me be instead. And again, I don't want to get into this at length here, but the bottom line was what it showed me was that when I came in here, I turned my drinking over to God and I kept everything else. Everything. And the sad irony is because it was too important to turn it over to God. How strange is that? Yeah. And I carry that thing around with me. It's you know, I'll just go down the list. I mean, the things that I hadn't turned over were my marriage, my relationship to my wife, my relationship to my children, my ex-wife, my job, my physical health, my finances, my life in AA. Can anyone think of anything else? I mean, you know, that's pretty much the whole deal, right? And so this thing's been helpful because the book talks about as we go through our day and we're disturbed or agitated, we pause, you know, and reflect on what God would have us be instead, you know, and that kind of thing. And this has been a good tool for that because when I get agitated and I've got this thing with me, I pull it out because I guarantee you that what I'm agitated about is on that list. And so I can revisit the fears, and I can refocus on that third column where it says, what would God have me be instead? And this has saved me from more amends than I care to think about. I'll give you an example. It didn't involve it might have involved amends. I never got there, but I'll tell you how I used this recently at work. I was working on a project, and I'm a project manager. You know, I'm responsible for this project, you know, the budget and the schedule and all that kind of stuff. And I get word that there's been a problem over there. I mean, you know, something fairly serious has happened with the potential to, you know, put me over budget, put me behind schedule, all this kind of stuff. And my first reaction is fear, you know. Here's the failure deal, and everybody's going to see it, and I was doing so good, and yada-da-da-da-da-da. So the self-centered response to that is, I'm going to hide this. You know, I'm not going to tell anybody about this problem. And what I'm going to do is dig into my records and look for enough stuff that I can cover myself with, and even better if I can blame this on someone else. You know, go to the card. Go to the card, and got refocused, said a prayer, and asked God to basically let me be open to solutions and not be afraid, you know. And so I went and talked to my supervisor about what was going on. I went and talked to my team about what was going on. I said, here's the problem. And that put 8 people working on the problem instead of me. And I wasn't working on the problem. I was just working on cover, you know. But now I've got 8 or 10 people working on the problem, and the solution came from one of them. Now my fear would have cut me off from that, you know. And you know, I mean, that's just an example of the ideas of this stuff in daily life. It just works amazingly well. So I guess from the standpoint of the whole program, I understand my program as being working the steps, carrying the message, and being involved in the fellowship. Sponsorship is incredible. I mean, you know, as a sponsor, I don't get someone sober, but as a sponsor, from time to time, you get blessed with seeing the miracle happen. And then they thank you. And you go, no. A guy once thanked me, and I said, no, you know, you're not going to understand this now, but I want you to remember this moment because you're going to carry this message to somebody else, and someday this is going to happen to you. You're going to watch the miracle happen, and they're going to thank you. And when that happens, remember this. You know, remember this. There's nothing that I do where I feel like I'm more centered, more doing what I'm supposed to be doing than when I'm sitting with someone doing the work. You know, that one-on-one stuff. I do other service work, but sponsorship is the one that's really a reward for me. So I guess the weakness right now in my overall program is the fellowship. I still struggle with meetings from the standpoint of the message that we're carrying. As I say, I came into these rooms and I heard a bunch of stuff, And now that I've done the work and I've gone through the book, I'm keenly aware when I go into meetings when we're carrying the message and when we're not. And I went into a meeting in Charlottesville not too long ago, where I, you know, it was a big open discussion meeting, and in the course of the meeting I briefly shared my experience doing the steps, and a little while later a guy in the back raised his hand, and he was coming back in from maneuvers, and this was his first meeting back, and he said he knew that the reason he hadn't made it was because he tried to do it himself. And I'm sitting there mentally rubbing my hands together. I've got a live one. All right. Well, before he had finished talking, two hands were in the air. And first one person and then the next person said variations of the same thing. You heard someone earlier, you know, welcome back. You heard someone earlier talking about the steps. I guess my life would be better if I'd done the steps, but I haven't, and I'm doing fine. You don't have to do them either. And this is an AA meeting. Yeah. So, resentments are my problem to the extent that I'm upset. Something spiritually matter with me. And I can tell you that something's spiritually wrong with me on this one. This is one that I struggle with, and as a result, I don't go to as many meetings as I think I probably should. But that's where I am today, and I hope it's not where I am tomorrow. And, you know, I know what to do for this. But I tend to stick to meetings where the focus is a message of hope. And what I kind of hope... what I kind of push when I talk is the idea that people think about when they're sharing in a meeting, not what they're trying to say. I've talked about this before in meetings, and people come up after the meeting and say, well, yeah, I think when we say, you know, take your time to work the steps, what we're really trying to say is blah, 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 blah. And my response is, I don't care what you're trying to say. The important thing to think about is how does the newcomer hear it? You know, our primary purpose is to carry the message of hope to the alcoholic who still suffers. And what we got to think about isn't what it means to us or what we're trying to say to someone else, but how the newcomer's going to hear it. You know, they've got to understand our job is to clearly tell them that there's a solution and what it is. You know, that's the only reason for me to go to meetings. You know, that and to be reminded by those of you who are doing the work that, oh yeah, you know, spiritual solution. I guess the only other thing that I kind of want to focus on is something that I've been interested in the last couple of years. And again, it has to do with something I hear a lot in meetings. You know, we come in here and our thinking's been pretty bad. I'm a real fan of the notion that alcoholics don't have denial. Denial is what Al-Anons have. Alcoholics are delusional. Yeah. And it's a girl. And I mean, back to really believing that I wasn't going to drink that day. That wasn't denial. I was delusional. I really believed it could happen. But we come in here and we're kind of, you know, our thinking is bad. I was insane. I mean, I see the insanity of the disease, and I hear a lot of people continuing to talk about, you know, when I'm in my own head, I'm behind enemy lines. You know, there's this fear that I have that, okay, everything's going great, but somehow I'm going to screw it up. Yeah, if left to my own devices, and I guess the key thing of that is left to my own devices, sure, but. I'm pretty dialed into the idea of a spiritual way of life now, and as long as I follow that, I don't have to be afraid of screwing things up. Because I don't think now the way I used to think. They had a thing in the book where it talks about at the end of the fear inventory, or when they're talking about fear, they say it once God commences to show us what to be. It's not what to do. I'm not so much concerned about doing the next right thing as I am concerned about being the kind of person God wants me to be. Because if I'm the kind of person that God wants me to be, I'm going to be, pull this list out. God wants me to be trusting, confident, loving, diligent, responsible, faithful, they're honest. There's some good words on here. I can't be those things on my own any more than I could go make that amend to that ex-friend on my own. I have to have the power, a higher power in my life to be those things. But if I'm doing what I need to do, that power does come into my life and I can start to be those things. And instead of wondering what the next thing is, next right thing is, or being afraid that I'm going to screw things up, I can go out in the world and act confidently. Instead of asking myself what would a good person do in this situation, I can approach life from the standpoint of I am a good person. I just act naturally. The right actions come naturally, and I don't have to be afraid that somehow I'm going to screw things up. It's kind of the last in a long line of fears. This fear that, okay, I can't get rid of this one inside, that I'm going to mess it up. But the longer I do this, the more confidence I have that the program works, and that if I can be the kind of person that God wants me to be, I don't have to be afraid. My wife and I went to a concert recently, and they sold beer and wine there, and she got a beer, and we're sitting in our seats, and she had to get something out of her pocketbook, so she bends down and says, "Here, hold this." And she handed it to me, and said, "Okay, that's interesting." But the cool thing about it was, what it showed me was, she doesn't even think about it. She doesn't have to worry about me. She's not having to walk on eggshells wondering what she has to do to keep from putting me at risk. My recovery is solid. Now, I say I'm a recovered alcoholic. That doesn't mean I'm cured. I stopped doing what I'm doing. I've still got the allergy. I stopped doing what I'm doing. I go pick up that drink. I'm off again. I'm not cured. But I have that daily reprieve. I'm recovered. I do not have the obsession to drink and have it in years. And my friends and my family don't walk on eggshells around me. They can behave the way they want to behave. They can act naturally and they can act normally around me without being afraid that they're putting me at risk. This program is about getting that power. So anyhow, I think that's about all I've got. I really thank you all for listening to me, and thanks for the privilege of talking to you tonight.